Welcome to this week's 2 Men in the Middle. This is where a bunch of middle-aged guys this week get together and talk about campaigns and politics and current events. I'm Craig Huey.
I'm Brandon Koenig.
Oh, and I'm Mike McCammon.
And Mike, who's been off for like a month and a half, forgot, I guess, how to talk into the microphone.
No, I thought you were going to like intro me, so I didn't know I was supposed to jump in.
And returning OG to the podcast, Mike McCammon.
Yeah, that's me, yes. Hello, how are you?
I'm doing good. How are you doing?
I'm fine. You know, it's post-election blues. It's been 3 weeks, so.
Has it been 3 weeks?
Or has it been two?
It's been three weeks,
yeah.
So we wanted to have you back out and just talk about your experience as a campaigner, kind of what your takeaways from this are, and just really we're looking for funny and entertaining anecdotes about you on the campaign trail. And
I should have wrote down a number of funny anecdotes to say because it's all
it's a big blur by this point.
Yeah, well, you know, it was not a blur. It's just it was quite interesting. I mean, the key takeaway we were just talking with Brandon about before he got here is the key takeaway is money. So, I mean, all the things that we dislike about American politics and we think we don't want to be true, I think kind of are. I told folks, like, I don't want to leave the race more cynical than I was, and I'm not, because I'm hopeful. I'm hopeful that, you know, eventually we'll break through, but you know, we tried to do something very different. It was a very unconventional campaign. I tell folks that if you take all the money that was spent in our race in the Kansas 3rd primary, Democratic primary, about $3.2 million on a primary that could have been used in the general election, by the way.
That's across all candidates, right?
That's across all candidates and the PAC money that came in as well.
Okay.
We spent like less than $50,000. So we spent like about 1.5% of all the money, and we got 7% of the vote. So we were excited, you know, from an ROI point of view, but that doesn't help you win an election. So
let's back up a little bit. When did you decide that you had to do this? Was there one thing? Was it just a cumulative effect? But when did you wake up and tell your wife, I'm going to run for Congress?
Well, it was a long burn. So I had been frustrated after the 16 election and had thought about running as early as like the day after Trump got elected. But then it was kind of this erosion of trust around how government worked that really kept me going on that path. The next thing after that was the Electoral College didn't do what it's supposed to do, which is make sure that like someone crazy doesn't get put into the White House. And then step number two was when Betsy DeVos got nominated and then confirmed by the Senate. And of course, anyone could see her from her resume. She was completely unqualified for the position.
Mike, she started Amway.
I guess. And then the third step was when the Republicans started dismantling the Affordable Care Act. And they're like, okay, that's it. Okay, I got to figure out a way to get involved.
So that was your breaking point.
Well, so let's be careful. So then what I did is I started reaching out to people that were running, and I reached out to a bunch of different nonprofits thinking there's some way to get involved to stop this whole mess. And I met one of the early candidates. Her name was Andrea Ramsey.
I remember that.
And I decided to get behind her, and I kind of like hibernated this idea for running, and I was on her kitchen cabinet and did all that. She fell out of the race in December because of a scandal. I mean, I don't think any of it's true, but nonetheless, she decided to get out of the race. I looked at the bench, and I didn't feel like anyone was very qualified, and I didn't think they were good candidates. And I said, okay, we still have the same problem. I guess I'm going to have to do it. So then I started meeting with people, and I made my final decision on around the 9th or 10th of February. We had a candidate forum on that Sunday, and if I filed for with the FEC on the Thursday before and I was officially a candidate, I could participate in the forum. And that's what drove my timing of my decision was right there in early February.
And even after you entered the race, other candidates.
Yeah, two more people got in after that. Two more got in.
And so you had a chance, obviously, to assess the other candidates, but you felt you still had something to offer that made you stand out.
Yeah, so and to be very specific, so the two people that came in after me were Sylvia Williams and Charisse Davids, both women that were in the race. Charisse I had met with about 3 weeks prior to me getting into the race, and I had made that assessment of her as well. I felt that she was inexperienced. I'm on the record of the Washington Post as saying that as well. And I felt like we needed to have someone that had some of the what I said is, when this is true, is that I wanted someone to represent me in Congress that had skills that were more around consensus building and around getting things done and around real achievements in their professional life. And I didn't feel like anyone in the race had that. And so I felt like I had to run. In fact, I even feel like Kevin Yoder didn't have that, quite frankly. So I felt like I had a pretty good chance.
Right. And you had a struck a centrist tone as well, which set you
absolutely
apart.
I was very much a moderate. You know, at almost every single event I went to, I always would bring up that the Kansas Third is moderate and it is mostly Republican. And I feel like that's the only person, that's the only path for victory in the race, for either side, by the way, is to be a moderate. You can't be too far ultra-con on the Republican side, and you can't be too lib over on the Dem side, or I don't think you can actually win the majority of the people in the Kansas Third. And I think it's really mistaken. You know, we had a lot of national press early on, I should say actually mid-summer time frame, when there was obviously some momentum getting behind the progressive candidate, Brent Welder, and then after the gal in New York 14 won, what's her name?
AOC,
yes. Alexandria. When she won in 14, there was like, oh my God, there's a progressive thing going to sweep the country. And they came out
premature,
here looking, yeah. And they came out here looking for that story. And I'm just like, okay, no, you know, this is not Brooklyn.
Well, and Craig and I have had this conversation over and over again about being able to run and speak to your district, and this idea that you can't have a cookie cutter candidate, especially a progressive candidate, and think that that's going to work across the United States.
Well, see, the thing is that, and I think this is true in both parties right now, is that if you can muster enough money, it doesn't matter what your position is, you can actually find a path to victory. So Sharice Davids didn't win our race, I think primarily on identity politics, on the back of a lot of PAC money that came into the race the last 5 weeks. But the person that came in second place, Brent Welder, was a progressive candidate. And he had a really great ground game. He had been working on for over a year. He had Bernie come into town, the whole deal. And so I think that, you know, and by the way, you know, at the end of the day, not everyone votes. And so if you can marshal enough people around a kind of narrow piece of the party, you might be able to sneak in and get in. But what I was trying to do is do much more of a I made a couple of big decisions. I made decisions that I wasn't going to raise a bunch of money, that I was going to do it unconventionally, that I was not going to flip-flop on my policies, that I was going to run on my record, and I was going to say what I wanted to say then and knowing that I was not going to change it when I got into the general. Because I could have been an ultra-lib and done a lot of things in the primary to kind of get out of the primary, fully knowing that I was going to get assaulted by that if I did get out. I mean, we've already having that problem right now with Sharice. When, you know, she was in the race, you know, she's on a podcast quoted as saying that she would abolish ICE. I was asked by the Washington Post the very same question when he was in town in July. And of course, I told him, no, I'm not going to do that. But she said that she would, at least in this particular podcast. Now, that's on record. And now she's having to kind of pull that back because that would be an unpopular stance in the district. So, but I mean, the thing is, I ran something that I felt was ethically genuine, something I can sleep at night. But unfortunately, that only appealed to 7% of the Democrats, which is remarkable to
me. So there's a couple of things there. So you were involved in this race when Bernie and AOC rolled into Kansas.
They did.
And so AOC. I tried it once. I'm not trying again. So AOC got 17,000 votes in one of the most liberal districts in America.
Right.
So was there really, give me an idea of did the Democrats in Kansas, was there really a thought that translated into Kansas, or was it just she's young? She delivers a message very well. She's energetic. Let's go out and say. I guess what I'm looking for. Please tell me the Democratic Party didn't honestly, intellectually think that 17,000 votes in one of the most liberal sections of the world would translate into Kansas.
I think there's some people that believe that. What I would say is that, you know, from where I stood, you could see that the progressive, you know, the calling card of the progressives in the party are, we used to joke internally that it's like running for a fifth grade student body president. You're going to like guarantee free pizza for lunch every day and longer recesses. So, but in reality, it's these three things. It's $15 minimum wage, it's universal health care, Medicare for all, and then free college. And so, you know, it's pretty, those three individually, I think, do have audiences that are very excited about that. I mean, of course, you know, Medicare for all, universal health care, is everyone on the record on the Democrat side said that we think we should get there at some point. you know, we can't, as I would say all the time on the campaign trail, we can't eat the whole cow in one bite. Yeah. You know, we got to go slow. But universal healthcare should be the destination at some point. Of course, free education, you know, that's a bugaboo, but people love to hear that. You know, we're just going to get free college to everybody. I don't know how I'm going to pay for that. And then the $15 minimum wage, which, by the way, I became very empathetic towards as I began to get to meet more and more people, particularly live in Wyandotte County, and the struggles that they have about making ends meet. You know, that's a very real problem. I'm not sure I'm totally on board with, you know, mandating that, you know, a minimum wage that high. But anyway, so what I'm saying is that I think there are groups of people that will gravitate to those messages and get very fired about it. And whatever candidate's going to take that message to, you know, Washington, I think can actually get elected or get votes. I don't know if they're going to get elected, but they can get votes.
So we talked about a few weeks ago that the current Democratic fascination with socialism is the freebies.
Well, it
is. Free.
And we tried a couple of times unsuccessfully to start calling it socialism and not call it progressive because, you know, I got in this kind of interesting conversation with one of the candidates because I was calling myself a progressive moderate, which he said, well, that's an oxymoron. You can't be both of those things. And I said, you know, I worked in the tech sector for 28 years, for God's sake. Like, you don't think I'm progressive? I'm all about big ideas. I'm all about trying to solve problems in a big fashion. I'm just not sure that the three things you've come up with are the right ones. In fact, what you're talking about is more social and not progressive. And we need to remember, again, that stuff that came out of Bernie's mouth. And of course, he's not a Democrat and all those other kinds of problems.
So. I guess that's where there's a thread through socialistic principle that you can ride. But it's not the free recess and what free doesn't get you there. Because socialism,
It does in some places. But I would say my assessment of the race at the end of the day, if I were to look at the Democratic Party, of course, Kansas is not representative of the rest of the union, of course. But I look at it and think, you know what? About a third of the people in the Democratic Party are all about identity politics.
About a third
of them are all about free stuff, socialism, all that, the progressive side of the party. And then the rest of the 40% is like regular people that are trying to find a way to reach across the aisle and get something done with the R's. Because that's what we need to do as a country, is to figure out ways to work together. I mean, I know you don't want to talk about this, I can talk about it later, but I mean, this is the real message for me that makes me so tragically sad about John McCain's death. It's like, that's what he tried to do. I mean, I know it's a little bit, I don't know how it's the right word I'm going to say. They're making it, They're romanticizing what he did because he wasn't probably that pure. But I do think that generation of statespeople, him and Bob Dole, tried really hard to work with the other side. And we don't have that today. And I think that what we're getting in our election process is we're not getting much of that, in my opinion.
So we'll definitely talk about the death of John McCain. But okay, so let's talk about the mood that you saw of the Democratic Party. And Kansas may not be indicative of the entire country.
They're ready to roll. They're fired up.
So it's fair to say, and I put myself in this category.
Blue wave.
I don't want to hear a single centrist moderate, I want to reach across the aisle. I want someone to go bare knuckle. Because without that, we're not going to get anywhere.
It was a big failure on my campaign that I didn't really have a message that resonated with that resist side of the party. So, you know, people are mad, they're pissed off, they don't like Trump, and they want to find a way to change that. And I didn't really have a message around. My message was, we need to have the courage to compromise. And everyone's just like, what the F are you talking about? Like, no. And I would tell people, I said, no, you understand, compromising with someone you disagree with is a hell of a lot harder than punching them in the face. I mean, punching in the face is actually, not only is it fun, it's pretty gratifying. But actually sitting down and trying to work through some compromise is actually quite complicated. But this nuance of like high learning was difficult to nail for the people.
Did you encounter like an overriding issue that stuck out, or was there even an issue? Was it more about just, we need somebody who's going to be independent and stand up to Trump? And that was the, you know, common thread. What did you see that kind of resonated over and over again?
Well, in terms of, the stories that I told, the ones that I felt resonated were just talking about the common dignity of the American people and how we try to do the right thing. I don't think that played very well, because the way most of the times you had public venues with the other candidates, the amount of time you had to be nuanced was very small. So you really just pretty much had to memorize a 90-second answer to healthcare. And it was never nuanced. It was never complicated or, you know, getting into any details. And even when you did your closing statements, you know, you get 2 minutes. That's not enough time to tell an interesting story about someone you met.
Right.
Now, when I was doing like meet and greets where I had control of the platform, you know, of the stage, if you will, and had 10 minutes to talk, you know, where I saw, I mean, the story that I've told, I don't know, if, well, I'll tell it here if you want me to tell it. One of the most moving stories that I encountered on the trail was about this common decency. So it was about 2 months ago when I met this guy, and it was right in the middle of all the big kids in cages thing and the border crisis, if you will. And so I tell the story that, you know, I was going out and meeting people in the district. I had a veteran contact me from Gardner, and he wanted to meet with me. And I said, sure, I'll come meet with you. He's a Republican. I sat down with him and his wife. He told me a story. So he enlisted right out. He was about 5 years younger than me. Enlisted right out of high school, did one tour of duty, came home. Have I told you the story, Craig? Have you heard the story? Okay. So he did his tour of duty, came home, got on with his life. And then after 9/11, he decided to reenlist, went in the guard on day 32 or whatever in Baghdad. The building he was in was bombed. Three people got killed. He took shrapnel, which is still, by the way, next to his heart, next to his lung. Oh, wow. PTSD, brain problems, leg problems, like the whole bad thing. And then for the next 10 years, all he did was like struggle with like getting benefits from the state of Kansas and the Kansas National Guard and DOD, all that kind of awfulness. And so at the end of the meeting, I asked the guy, I said, hey, you know what? What can we do? What can I do when I get elected to help you? All right. And he looked at me very quietly and he just said, don't put kids in cages. And I'm sitting there thinking, okay, this guy has every right to ask for anything. Okay. He's been through a shitstorm for the last 15 years of his life. And all he wants is our country to act with some dignity with people that have less than us. And when I was at my meet and greets, I would tell people, like, that's the America that we live in. It's not the one I see on TV. That's where we live. And we need to find ways to make sure that we treat people with dignity and respect. And that really resonated with people because they could see the human connection of that story. But of course, I never had a chance to tell that in a lot of different venues. And that was just one little story of someone that I met. And of course, it was much more poignant in the moment when we had all the issues of the border crisis. But, you know, at the end of the day, it really is around distilling your campaign down to a 30-second TV ad or a 90-second answer to candidate forum. It is not about nuance. It's not about being authentic. It's not about meeting lots of people. You know, we were doing Facebook Lives in the last 2-3 weeks of the campaign. We go on for 30 minutes unscripted, talk to people around the district. Very interesting, get lots of people watch the videos. But at the end of the day, I think people really just want, you know, they'll sit there and they want to have something, but then they vote in a way that doesn't necessarily match up with that. They're voting.
Well, it seems like they want a story, like the narrative.
They do.
And Craig
they
spoke
do.
To that, because even if you look at your opponents, their TV ads were all built around these stories, you
yes,
know,
they
and being
were.
Able to tell them.
Well, and everyone always wants to hear the, you know, rags to riches, like you didn't have this and now you have it, you know, this kind of like narrative of the American dream. People like to hear that. And then, you know, but when it gets down to like the brass tacks of policy, you know, people don't like to talk much about that. And if you get much past the 90-second answer on healthcare, what I found is that most people didn't really have very much. Mm-hmm. You know, we would go, I remember one candidate forum we had up in Kansas City, Kansas, in Wyandotte County. And one of the questions was, like, you know, what would we do to increase the economic benefit to the Wyandotte County? And I've basically been sitting in a meeting with people in Wyandotte County for the past 2 months. And I'm thinking, holy shit, how do I answer this question in 90 seconds? Like, there's like, this is like a 2-day seminar that we need to get 50 people together to have this conversation. But of course, everyone just kind of, it was really interesting to see how people responded, because one person got up and just talked about the $15 minimum wage. You know, they just went right back. They basically looked through their card file. What's the memorized
talking point?
What's the 90-second speech I've got that kind of fits in onto this? And they just did it.
We call that the Kellyanne Conway effect.
And I mean, you know, I lost. So, I mean, let's be careful here. I mean, this is what people want. They don't want what I tried to provide, which was nuance and being a genuine, real person.
Well, and speaking of what you're trying to provide, you stood out because you ran on not accepting PAC money. So
that's
you
correct.
Created very distinct separation from the rest of the field.
And, well, and not necessarily. So what was interesting about that? Sorry, we'll go ahead and finish your thought.
Well, I was just going to add, so, you know, let me know if this assessment is correct. My feeling that when it comes to like PAC money and money in politics, it's kind of similar to negative campaigning, right? People, you know, bemoan the influence, they hate it, they talk about how much they dislike it, but they respond to it. So at the end of the day,
exactly.
Those same people who complain about it it impacts their vote. They respond to it.
The harsh term to use would be hypocrite, but I won't use that word. It was really interesting for me. It's like when I first got in the race, one of the other candidates had a pledge on his site that he would not take corporate PAC money. And I thought, why is the word corporate in front of it?
Who was that?
That was Brent Wilder.
Okay.
I'm like, why does he put the word corporate
in front of it? We name names on the pod, Mike.
Okay, well, that's all right. So I'm like, why is the word corporate in front of it? And then I began to learn that Democrats are cool with PAC money as long as it's not from companies, okay? You know, if it's about, like, promoting women's rights or reproductive rights or unions or what, I mean, and they're all great. I'm not saying anything wrong with these people, but I'm like, okay, they're PACs too, okay?
So
let me just
unpack what you just said. A politician of any stripes is cool with money. Well, I'm going to pass out. What?
No, it's true. I know you, yeah. Do you not believe that?
They won't turn down money as long as it aligns with their ideological viewpoints.
Well, I'm not even sure if that's the case.
I was going to say, Mike, in other news, the sun was found to be hot this week.
Exactly. I know you're being
politicians
sarcastic.
Love money.
So so we ran on the idea that we were not going to take PAC money. And now, of course...
Why?
Because the idea is that corrupts my thinking on how things work.
Would it?
Everyone's got their price, right? You would think. Here's what I would say. Everyone thinks Citizens United is the worst thing that's ever happened. Do we believe there will ever be a legislative solution to Citizens United?
No.
Because everyone who's in office benefits from the system as it exists. I mean, even Brent Wilder, which was so funny, there was this PAC, I can't remember the name of it. There was a PAC that spent a bunch of TV money, like, I don't know, it was like $250,000 or whatever, the last 3 weeks of the race, yeah. Running this ad that, you know, Brent Wilder's
In spending PAC.
Another oxymoron. In spending PAC. So the in-spending PAC, I guess that's the name of it. They spent, I think it was like $250,000 running these ads. It was like, Brent Wilder's too progressive for Kansas. And the idea, as I understand it, was to basically get Brent Wilder elected over Sharice because it get the progressives out to vote for him.
Right. The ads, you made me like think 20, that it was like a pro
It was like Wilder 25 ad. Seconds of it yeah. were positive, and the last five at the end was, Brent Wilder's too progressive for Kansas.
It was almost like a Claire McCaskill play, like exactly. What she did with Todd Akin, which exactly. I thought was interesting. Yeah.
So it was so funny because like Brent got up and got all mad about it, and then a couple of the other candidates in our race got mad about it, and it was just like, oh my God, are you guys kidding me?
More shocking revelations. Kansas doesn't like progressive candidates?
Well, I mean... I guess.
That's but, a no.
They were hoping to lift him over the finish line. I mean, that was the reason for those ads, was to get Brent Wilder elected, not Sharice elected.
So 2 years from now.
No one did any negative ads on me, which is, I feel like somewhat of a compliment.
Brandon and I were just going to go off one night and say, don't ever vote for Mike. We're going to spill like every secret we know about Mike.
Oh, there you go.
But we figured for the 15 people that listened to the pod.
Yeah, well,
and most of our audience is outside of the Kansas City area.
I'll tell you
area.
What, though, you know, kind of interesting. Like, Sharice is kind of in a little bit of a mess with podcasts because she was on a podcast a couple weeks ago or a couple months ago, saying that she kind of agreed with the host that they would abolish ICE.
That to me is more problematic than PAC money, because what you just said is she stated an opinion and now she's in trouble for it. If that's
well,
the
now
way
she's
you,
walking it back.
But if that's what you truly believe, stand up for that
well,
and
I
make
agree.
The case
and
to
very
why
careful.
You want to
you know,
say
I
ICE.
I got baited a couple times by the press, including the Washington Post. Do you? And I remember being asked the question: do you want to abolish ICE?
Jeff Bezos, bastard.
No, it's not him.
That's him, isn't it?
Well, yeah, he owns it. But yeah. Trust me, I did not have a sit down with Jeff Bezos. But in my sit down with the editor, He wanted me to say, "Do you want to abolish ICE?" In fact, even Maloney did Channel 9 News, and I said, "No, I think we should suspend the funding for ICE and find out what the hell is going on." Because clearly they're not working against, you know, what people believe they should be doing in the states.
Yeah. I think that's a good point because I followed that. And I think that is going to cause some headaches for Davids because, I mean, she was pretty unequivocal like in her response on podcast. And now she's basically saying, I didn't mean that at all.
I joked with one of my friends. This is totally bad for me to say this in the podcast. But I was joking with one of my friends. She is actually, I underestimated her ability as a politician because you say one thing and then later you say something different.
She's a lawyer, Mike.
Nothing wrong with lawyers. I like lawyers. They're great.
Do you know any lawyers?
Not many.
So let's talk a little bit about identity politics.
Oh man, really?
So it is. It was my position that a moderate,
wow, you're going to go
middle of the road, middle-aged white guy had no chance in any Democratic primary.
For the record, this is Craig talking.
Oh yeah, this is Craig. Yeah, this is Craig talking. Number one, across the board, women are generally performing, I think I saw a study, 15 to 17 points higher across the board than they ever have. At any other time in American history. So part of it might just be, it just wasn't the cycle. You talked about how your message didn't resonate. Yeah. Maybe it was just, we're just not in that cycle. Centrist, moderation, compromise, that's not where the Democratic Party is right now. I think I told you.
I think the results would speak for themselves.
I think I told you this story that I know somebody who was at lunch with some folks. And they all said, man, I love Mike McCammon's signs. He's got great signs. I love that over
awesome.
Yoder thing.
They were awesome.
That's really, really sweet. And this person said, oh, so you're going to vote for Mike? And they're like, absolutely not. And she's like, well, who are you going to vote for? Charisse. Why are you voting for Charisse? Because it's our time to have more women in Congress. It is more important to support a female candidate at this point in time than it is to actually know what they stand for, what are the issues, and how they actually go, how they actually are going to perform as a congressman.
I'm just going to do a public service announcement. Craig Huey is never running for public office.
Why would you? Why would? Isn't that obvious as the nose on your face? I don't understand why that's that is. That is the most obvious statement ever made on the pod.
The thing that I naively believed is that people could see me as an advocate for women. That just as I'm an advocate for immigrants, just as I'm an advocate for people of color. But, you know, people don't operate at that plane. I mean, they operate in a much different plane.
And especially now, they don't.
Yeah, you know, and it doesn't help that, you know, there's lots of good examples of very misbehaving old white guys when it comes to a whole variety of issues, and that is a negative for someone like me that tries to run.
And the most obvious example of that isn't the guy running the country right now, right?
Well, he is the most obvious example of that. So it's, you know, it is what it is. You know, I felt that I could tell a story and I could appeal to people's common sense that what we need to do is work with the other side and figure out how we're going to win the district. Can I tell everyone, like, you know, for all the fanfare of winning a primary, really the only thing the Democratic Party did was pick their favorite flower. We haven't won anything yet.
No.
Like, we got to win the general.
The general test is ahead.
Yeah. Exactly. If we don't win the general, it doesn't matter. And, you know, and then it's like, okay, now we pissed away, you know, 3.5 plus whatever else they're going to spend, or 3.2 plus whatever else gets spent on, you know, not winning back the seat. And so at the end of the day, like, you know, we need to be really careful what we're trying to accomplish.
Can she beat Yoder?
Wow, you're going to put me on record for that. I think she can. There's a path. I think, you know, what was amazing to me is how much the vote turnout for the primary. In 14, the last non-presidential year primary, we had 22,000 people vote. In 16, it was 33,606. In this race, it was over 60,000 people voted. It's like almost a 50% growth. So people came out, you know, and I'm not sure how many were unaffiliated. Actually, well, we can go into this cul-de-sac if you'd like. I went and did some surveys after the race was done, and I've actually come to the conclusion that I may have actually helped Kris Kobach get elected, get the nomination for the Republican.
Get out.
Here's the math I did. So I went and looked at the people that voted for me, that said they voted for me, and saw how many of them were unaffiliated, and I backed into the math, and it was about 400, 500 people. And then it occurred to me, I personally know at least 50 to 100 people that I know would vote Republican if I was not in the race, and there's no way in hell they would have voted for Kobach. So I'm actually beginning, not only am I sad about losing, but I'm also sad that I may have actually enabled the most awful person to be running for governor in our state's history.
And made him this much closer to becoming the next governor. Oh.
Pot over.
So anyway, it was, am I supporting Charisse? I want a Democrat. I don't want a Republican. So I think she's going to have some big challenges if she gets elected to be effective for a whole bunch of variety of reasons. And I really, really, really want her to start talking about the issues and not about her identity.
So we've kind of had this conversation, but my my thought on this is a freshman congressman from Kansas.
Congressperson, we have done this over and over and over again.
Whatever, however you want to say it, is one of the least effective jobs you could have in the United States.
I disagree.
Because you have one vote, and that vote is who is Speaker of the House.
See, I had this really delightful conversation with some leadership in the Kansas Democratic Party after my loss, and I kind of wanted to give them the opportunity to make me eat crow because they had told me I needed to run for a different race and not run for Congress, and they had brought this up. And you know, I said I disagree with that. I mean, I think that it would be very hard, of course, to be effective when it comes to getting an agenda forward in the House. I mean, I completely agree with that. But the role you play in that job as a potential convener in this area is substantive. I mean, if you wanted to talk about healthcare or immigration or the equity of education in the district or any of that stuff, you can bring a convening together. I mean, you know, I tell folks, Kevin Yoder can get any microphone in town on any day of the week on any broadcast television that he wants, and he doesn't ever. So the idea is that, like, you know, change happens, I think, from the bottom up. And so if you could in 2 years make a very big difference in the conversations around the third, around people connecting around the issues that matter to us and having good conversations to educate everyone, to put together a platform that would be supported in D.C. And you need to focus, look here first and not just at D.C., if that makes any sense.
I agree with that. I think from an advocacy perspective, you have an outsized voice, a megaphone.
Absolutely.
I would say, though, that in terms of, you know, overall policy and legislative effectiveness, you know, that comes in time. Yeah, because you have to get committee assignments, leadership posts, you know, and without those, it is difficult to propel anything forward. It takes years as far as legislation goes.
And I think, you know, we tried a little bit of this on the campaign trail, too. I think, again, if you get elected into that role, you also, again, you have the microphone. You have this oversized microphone that, you know, I sent an open letter to Mark Zuckerberg around how they could increase the trust and integrity of the Facebook platform. Now, of course, he's not going to pay attention to me, but if I was a member of Congress, I might actually get that attention. And again, you know, I was talking about on the campaign trail, I think that regulation is the thing you should do as a last resort. I mean, what you should try at last resort. You really should try to figure out ways to move public opinion in a way that kind of nudges companies to do the right thing. And I think you can do that very effectively as even a freshman member of Congress in a way that you cannot do as a private citizen. And I think that's actually one of the things I would have been focusing on in addition to participating in the legislative process, but fully knowing that I was not going to be as effective because I was a freshman member.
Right. Well, a moment ago, you touched on a couple of human interest stories that you encountered during the campaign. That's another area where a congressperson can be very effective to draw attention to those types of stories, particularly like on immigration. I mean, we have local stories of people that are impacted by policy.
They're insane. Yeah. I'll tell you that the issue that struck most to me, I mean, healthcare was a big one, but the immigration issue is quite remarkable, and we don't talk enough about it, and we don't talk honestly about it. When I met a lot of folks that are Dreamers and the people that are involved in the Dream Alliance and that kind of stuff in KC, Mo, and KC, Kansas. You know, as native-born Americans, we have no idea what that life is like. And we don't hear about those stories either because they don't tell those stories very publicly for fear of being deported or whatever kind of retribution they may have. You know, if you're a 7-year-old kid, when your parents put you in the car and drive you to the U.S., you have no choice in that matter. And then to think that for the rest of your life, you're in this kind of undocumented, obscure status around getting a job, around going to college, around all these other issues, knowing that the government could just decide at anyone's moments that you're going to get, you know, shipped out of here, is just remarkable to me. And we don't talk about it. You know, we're just going to go on to the next Trump thing because that's more entertaining than talking about what we're going to really do about Dreamers or immigrants, whatever the case might be.
Anybody listening to this pod knows I'm as negative as negative can be on the legislative branch of our government. And I think one of our core problems is one of the three pillars of government has just shut down. They are not living up to their responsibilities. You talk about the immigration situation. How many versions of Congress have just absolutely not done anything to let this get to where it is now? Now it's the point that it's gotten even worse. And the biggest offenders of this, Paul Ryan, Mitch McConnell. Well, thank God Paul Ryan is going. But the reality too is there's nothing that can happen in the House that will pass the Senate right now.
Right.
We've talked about the best thing that a blue wave does is just gridlock for 2 years.
Yeah, they basically impede the path of the president.
Correct. They bring the Trump legislative presidency to an end.
Yeah, they do, and then they work the courts and executive orders best they can to get what they want, because they can't get it done through the legislature.
And McConnell has already said the Senate is in the business, is in the personnel business. They're about judges. They're not about legislation. They have a rule under McConnell right now that they will not take under any piece of legislation that they know Trump won't sign. Wow. So I guess my point is, it's difficult
right
now.
So what do you do about that, though?
I don't know.
So that's the real question.
Number one, you get Mitch McConnell out of the way. That's number one.
And I think what you got to do is you got to find a way to find citizen legislators to actually go to D.C. that are going to try not to take money and to try to represent the values of their district, that are not there to have a career, that are willing to take some risks to get some shit done.
So we've talked about this.
But that, by the way, that gets you 7% of the vote.
If I would, one of the things for the Democrats right now is democracy 2.0. Here are 15 things that we do still in our democracy based on tradition, based on they were invented in the 1780s, that make absolutely no sense. That if we just agreed on these, things would get significantly better. We're not voting on Tuesday anymore because nobody rides a horse and nobody takes 2 days to get there. We're voting 3 days, Friday, Saturday,
Sunday.
Have the
weekend off, yeah.
That's what it is. Hey, guess what? To pass a Supreme Court justice, it's always 60 votes. You've got to build some consensus. And if you can't do that, you don't get get to do anyone. Find somebody else. How about this one? Term limits. We've talked about this. Age limits. You have to be under 65 to take the oath of office of presidency. Forced retirement. If you're 80, I'll up it even. It should be like said, we can't have Orrin Hatch and Dianne Feinstein in their 80s still sitting there holding Senate seats. Why can't the Democrats take something like that?
I don't know. I mean, I signed the term limit pledge, and I had independently come to the same conclusion that no one should serve in Congress more than 12 years. And I think that, I don't know about an age limit, but I think I would be in favor of all that stuff.
The average age of Congress keeps getting older and older. If you look at over the past 30 years, the Congress we have now, the average age is the oldest, which is just amazing to me. But in addition to term limits, having rules on how long you can serve in leadership positions in the House and Senate, so we can get fresh, new forward-thinking people in those spots. But I've mentioned this to Craig, but if there was like an agenda, a blueprint for reform with so many action items, and again, you keep it high level so that all of the candidates under the party banner can get behind it, but it's something they can go to the American
people.
Well,
we talked about this in our campaign, and one of the things we did not come up with, and I should probably get this list of 15 things, is that, we talked about it, the way the Democrats get elected in a wave, and maybe this is something for 2020. Don't steal this, Mr. R.
He's a soft R.
He's a soft R. Is, you know,
lowercase R.
And it was street cred here. Well, I'm going to bring up this one marketing gimmick that was very, very good, which was the Contract for America. So the idea is to come up with a platform.
I was thinking exactly.
Have a platform that's got 15 points and say we're going to all get on board with this and run on that. And then the idea is you may actually be able to sweep your way in the way the Tea Party and all the kind of moderate Republicans did when it came to the Contract for America.
Modernization, cut down corruption, facilitate change. Those are the three pillars that.
Where are you getting that? Are you making this up?
I'm making the, because it's so goddamn obvious. That's why I can make it up. It's so simple.
What were the three
if
again?
You're 88, I'll listen to the podcast. You shouldn't be in the Senate. We should vote 3 days because nobody rides a horse anymore.
Well, I agree with that.
These are simple. You can come up with these at the top of your head. You don't need a pack, you don't need a poll. These are simple things wrong with democracy.
Is this the think tank that's going up in North Kansas City up there?
We should form, and I've told this to Brandon, why don't we form like a, I don't know what to call it.
I'm in. All in.
Let's go.
What's it called?
I don't know what it's called. I said political action committee. Yeah, but we got to have a better name than that.
What was the name?
That's its technical name. Democracy 2.0.
Democracy 2.0 is not bad.
Well, you can market, call it whatever you want.
Okay.
I don't know what the type of organization is.
Here's what I want to know.
It's a 501c, whatever.
It's a four or five, six,
whatever it takes.
So where were you when I needed you in the Mike campaign? Like, you know, that's, you're the reason why. Oh, now I know.
You're the start with
you're the
me.
Reason why I lost. No, I now know.
Don't start with
you bastard.
Me.
I can't believe you made me lose.
We've got to get past, to your point, there's no way you can stand in front of a crowd and give your 30 seconds how you're going
to
solve health.
Here's the other things I wanted to do. In fact, I actually, this is on my website still. I thought when it came to primaries, I think there should be actually spending limits in terms of how much money people can spend on their primary. Yeah. I thought there should be like a luxury tax that if you overspend it, like money goes into a pot so that way we can get more diverse candidates the next cycle around. There's all kinds of things you could do to make these things work a lot better. But right now there's no rules. It's basically, okay, raise as much money as you want. Do anything. There's no rule book. There's no policy guide. There's no document you sign. And in fact, so here's another idea. We could vet our candidates before as well. Because right now there's nothing. Get this. I was able to run for U.S. Congress with less scrutiny than if I decide to volunteer for a nonprofit.
Absolutely.
If I volunteer for a nonprofit, I got to fill out a piece of paper that does a criminal background check.
Because I asked them, like,
I don't have to do that if I'm running for Congress.
They
got to
do a criminal background check on you, right? You had to give up your social other stuff. And you're like, no. Just file some paperwork.
No, it's just go to the website, fill out two forms. You are a candidate.
Wait, there's no like shady campaign operative digging through your trash like in the Will Ferrell
there might
the
be.
Campaigns.
Well, they realized that I was not going to draw more than 10%. So... I didn't have a tracker. You know, I would have had to be a much more serious candidate to have a tracker.
So I think what this experience has shown again is this is about money. This is about money, and it's about forming an identity that syncs up with the cycle the party's in.
I mean, it is at the end of the day. I never thought of this analogy just now. It is very much like Coca-Cola. I mean, it's about marketing and a message. It is not about what it is or what it does to you or if it's good for you or bad for you.
I disagree with that.
What do you mean you disagree with it?
Because
it's marketing.
But you just said it. You can have whatever message and marketing you want. If you don't have enough money to get in front of
the eyeballs. I mean,
and
RC Cola might be a better product with a better message.
It might be. Ain't nobody ever drinking that shit because it ain't Coca-Cola.
Because they don't have enough money to do all the TV advertising on the Super Bowl.
There's certain cycles within politics that people just don't want to hear certain stories. And right now, there's only one story that gravitates.
Yeah. Resist.
If you look at Sharice's commercials... I mean, she was in MMA gear punching things. How much more clear does it have to be? My only real thing I'm running on is I'm going to fight. Period. That's all she ever talked about.
And what I said is that what I've learned in my professional career is that when you walk into the room and punch someone in the face, you don't usually get good results. We don't care.
I'm not disagreeing with that, but I don't care. It's like the women at lunch. Are you going to vote for Mike? You like this message? You like saying, nope, it's just a woman's time to go.
I had multiple people come up to me and tell me that they were going to vote for somebody else based upon their sex, which to me, I was like, I cannot tell you how many times I wanted to say, can I play that back for you real quick? But that's where we are.
Right. Well, I don't think it's any coincidence that Democrats chose a woman as their nominee for governor as well. So it's, you know, that you're
Laura
the woman.
I think that's a little
narrative.
Different. That's a little different. I mean, Laura Kelly is a very, very experienced state senator. She's very much a policy person. In fact, she was kind of a little bit crippled in terms of the fact that she wasn't as flamboyant of a candidate as like a Svati or a Karl Brewer. But I mean, she is rock solid when it comes to policy.
Oh,
so
I agree. And
so
I'm
that's
not,
different.
And I'm not down in her spirits, but I think the margin, she did win even more overwhelmingly than people thought. They thought it would be a closer race between her and the other two.
She also gets a 15-point bump this year because she's running as a woman.
Yeah,
that's my point.
But let's be careful. One thing I will say, it is a little different because we had Sylvia Williams also ran in our race, and she did worse than I did. So there were two women in the race, and Sylvia did not break through. And she spent she was on TV now, not to the extent that Sharice was, but she was on TV. She ran a fairly traditional campaign, spent six times more money than I did, and she got like less than half as many votes as I did. So
all I'm saying again, and this
it's
is
not
just
it's not this, just this a woman.
Just,
you got to have a message too,
fact.
And you got to have the money.
Women are overperforming in political races, period. There's no, that is a fact right now.
So I really wonder how much time we've been going.
Because there's really a, freaking me out. Mike is, have you seen him look at his watch?
Well, no, I was trying to find out how much time we've gone. I used to always get freaked out. I can't see the screen.
What do you think? What do you
think? Like 50 minutes already or something.
43.
Oh, okay. Oh, my God.
Have you liked the hour pods? Have you got more used to it?
The hour pods are good. You know, you gotta keep my interest the whole time. So hopefully I haven't done that so well in this one. The things that I would say is there's a lot of things that are interesting about the race. It was very fun to do. I want to be on record to say it was very fun. I had like one of the core strategies was meet lots of people. I had like 206 one-on-one face meetings with the mayors, the chiefs of police, to pastors, to school districts. I mean, like everyone, business owners, doctors, everything. And mental health, I mean, everyone got great stories. I am convinced I know the district better than any single person, even Kevin Yoder for that matter, because I met everybody. And I spent every minute doing that. And it was really remarkably rewarding in that respect. It was just very disappointing that you can't find your way through a primary by being connected to the district. There's outside forces that are beyond your control, or maybe within your control when it comes to money, that could have done that. Now, I look at Tom Nierman, the guy who finished ahead of me. He had $800,000. He spent like $800,000. He had 15 times more money, and he only had twice as many votes. If you add all three people below Brent, so Brent, Charisse were the top two, if you add third place through sixth place together, we could not have broken second place.
Isn't that to be expected? The female candidate and the socialist progressive candidate were the top one, top two, because that's the narrative that's playing through the Democratic Party.
Yes. Yeah.
And both of those candidates struck a more, aggressive, combative,
tone. Absolutely.
You know, Tom is a little bit more mild-mannered. He comes very across much so. Very quiet, softer.
He's more mild-mannered than I am.
It's not what people are looking for. But yeah, I would agree. So your working knowledge, I think, of like Johnson County, Wyandotte County, Miami County has to just be enormous at this point based off of all the meetings.
I'll do the quiz for you, Brandon. So what is the number one problem in DeSoto and Lewisburg and Spring Hill?
No idea.
I've got an answer. They're in Kansas.
Which is kind of related to the fact that they don't have high speed internet.
No,
what? So
they don't have high speed internet in these exurbs, like these little rural areas outside of town. So they can't grow. People want to move to those areas, but they don't have high speed internet.
So you mean to tell me nobody in DeSoto, Kansas, can watch Netflix?
Well, I think they can, but the point is that if you want to do a business, they want to have Google. They want to have Google Fiber. They want to have fiber. They want to have high speed.
They have cable connections, right?
They do have cable, and they do have DSL.
That's high speed.
I'm just saying that was their number one issue when you asked the mayors of those towns. The other one I tell people is, what does the Kansas City, Kansas school district have in common with Burns and Mac?
I know the answer to this one, so you got to guess.
What does the Kansas City, Kansas school district have in common with Burns and Mac?
Yeah, the big engineering firm.
Turnover issues, retention, employee retention.
That's kind of related. The big issue is continuity of budgets.
Ah,
continuity of funding. So, in the case of Burns and Mac, the continuing resolutions to make it so they don't know how much money they're gonna have for next year,
right,
really affects their ability to hire and grow their business. And it's the same problem the Kansas City, Kansas school district has, because they don't have a big foundation to fund after every school year the way like Blue Valley and Shawnee
and
Mission
others.
Does.
Yeah.
Here's the other one that was even more crazy. What does the abortion issue and immigration have in common?
You want to take a stab at this, Craig?
Craig's like, stand as far away from the mic as he can. This one's a little bit harder to thread. So I met a woman, another fantastic person I met on the campaign trail, former nun. She left the order and raised a family, got married, raised a family. And throughout her career, she actually was a nurse practitioner. Okay. And she spent most of her time, she spent trying to talk women out of having abortions, because she's Catholic.
Mm-hmm.
So she was telling me the story that, like, she was a nurse practitioner before Roe v. Wade. And she said she knew four women that died having an abortion.
That's a very important point to make.
And what she talked about was that how, you know, abortions were always happening. It just, whether or not they were safe or not, and whether or not they were legal.
Yeah.
And the way this is similar to the immigration issue is that when I started meeting with all these dreamers, I found out, okay, wait a second. The problem that we had with abortion was that people had to live in the shadows until we finally legislated a solution to the problem. And that's the same thing that's happening in immigration. They have to live in the shadows until we legislate a solution. it's no different. That's, I mean, it's very different, obviously. But at the same time, until we actually come to face with what really is happening, you know, there are 11,000 to 13,000 undocumented people living in Wyandotte County. How many do you think are living in Johnson County?
Oh,
15,000 undocumented people living in Johnson County. So there's 28,000 undocumented people living on the Kansas side of Kansas City, Missouri, and we don't want to talk about it.
Basically in limbo, you know.
In complete limbo. And they live in the shadows. Like, okay, so if they witness a crime, they're not going to talk to the cops. Because if they do, they're going to ask them, so where do you live? Can I see your driver's license? All of a sudden, so now they don't report crime. You know, I mean, they if they need to get medical care, they don't. I mean, it's just the whole thing is just until we confront these issues and say, okay, this really is something that's happening. It's going to happen whether we do something about it or not. Can we be at least be humane and like make a decision so these people can get on with their lives? And right. These were some of the most fantastic things that I learned when I was out there walking the district. And I don't, and I know that none of the other candidates did because they were spending almost all their time on call time trying to raise money because right. that's how they figured that that's how they're going to win the election. Whereas I thought I could win it by going out and meeting people.
Well, and just the extent of it, too. I think sometimes we get in our own bubbles, particularly people who live in Johnson County, that part of the
absolutely.
District, and think, oh, we're not impacted by this or not to that degree.
Well, I'll tell you, I mean, it's very easy to live in South Johnson County and never go north of 435. I mean, by the way, and I'm talking about the north side of the South Loop.
Right.
That's to get on I-35, and you know, like you go into Wyandotte County, to get on I-35, you know, you don't even ever go, you never get off and turn left, okay? But even then, you got to go over the railroad bends and all that kind of stuff to get, and up the next hill to even get down into Wyandotte County. And if you go, you got to go even further to get to the northeast part of Kansas City, Kansas. It is, I met so many wonderful people all across the district, literally from Spring Hill to Kansas City, Kansas, to the northeast, Quindaro. And, you know, my wife and I are planning to start a couple of nonprofits that are going to help people in those parts of the parts of our state. Because it's the right thing to do. And even though I didn't win the election, we can still try to help people. And then maybe you never know what happens, you know, going forward in the future.
I was
going to
say, may we see Mike McCammon on the ballot at some future point in time?
I don't know. I mean, there's a lot of things that would have to happen. I really enjoyed it. I would love to run again, but I'm a little bit more aware of what I'm up against. The only problem with me is that usually if the challenge is bigger, it makes me even more motivated to do something. So, I don't know. I really had a good time and I know I do have a calling for public service and I want to find a way to make that happen. Maybe not elected, maybe in some other capacity.
You know what you could do, and we've talked about this multiple times to
start a podcast.
Well, squelch that down is you need to start watching more TV.
Oh, is that what I need to do?
If I were you right now, I would be firing up my Netflix account and catching up on all the TV you haven't watched in the last year.
Well, I haven't watched much TV, and my wife did and I did go see a movie.
What movie did you see?
I knew you were going to ask me that.
Forgot it already? I'll tell you what, Jode and I last weekend went and saw Black Klansman. Very good.
Oh, I hadn't seen that.
Very good.
No, it was another movie that... Oh, we saw Crazy Rich Asians.
How was that?
It was, you know, I thought it was supposed to be really funny, and, yeah. And there were some parts that were funny, and you know, and I tell you, like I've tried to be really over this whole race identity thing, so this whole point that like the entire cast is Asian, I'm like, I don't care.
Okay.
Like, I'm coming here to watch a good movie. Like, I'm not here to make some, like, social statement that I can watch a film with all Asians.
You're not showing everybody how woke you are go watching.
I'm going to see a movie.
The Asian people at it.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and it was, and it's funny, like, I've traveled to Singapore. I've only been there once, I suppose. But so it's the country that we live in, and people want to act certain ways. And a lot of times it's not very genuine.
Yeah.
And, you know, when I was up in Wyandotte County, I didn't see many people that were on the campaign trail. And I didn't see a lot of people from Johnson County up there. And we plan to be up there a lot going forward because, you know, that's how change happens is when we have collisions and meet with other people and get to know one another.
So let's spend the last couple of minutes here talking about John McCain, who passed away.
Do you want Brandon on this mic?
Saturday.
I don't have much to say about John.
So, no, I'll step out because, Brandon, you're as the Republican here, I'd like to hear from your side kind of what John McCain meant to your party. And now that he is gone, what does someone replace it? What are your expectations, I think, of the Republican Senate with him not there?
Well, I think the Senate is a completely different place now. I've had the great satisfaction of meeting Senator McCain on a couple of occasions and being able to speak with him. And you will not find somebody who is more down to earth and is the same person in front of all audiences, in front of all people. And I think what is, most just jarring about his passing is the fact that, you know, it almost feels like we're losing a part of our own identity as Americans. I mean, John McCain, you know, I think represents who we want to be. It's our aspirational idea of America and who we think we are. And this ability, you know, this... that he, you know, has fought back from all kinds of, torture and survived and then dedicated his life to public service. And he wasn't in it for the fame, for the glory, for the money. I mean, he completely did it because he wanted to give back to his country because his country gave him so much. And the interesting thing I heard time and time again was he never held a grudge. You know, he would be passionate and he would get into arguments with his fellow members of Congress, and then the next day be going out with a beer with them. It's losing part of ourselves because there is nobody like that. I don't see anybody in the wings who represents that, who has that ability to reach across the aisle when it comes to issues like immigration, like healthcare, like education, as he did. I thought it was also telling that he passed away on the same day as Senator Ted Kennedy, who he worked with. Disease. Yeah, of the same disease, but who he worked with time and time again, reaching across the aisle. And so it's a major loss. It's a huge loss for the Republican Party because he represented what the Republican Party used to be. It's not that party anymore. And
I almost think that it's politics is not what it is anymore.
Right.
I mean, not to be too romantic, but I think that there was a time in politics where and I think the generation that fought in World War II, Korea and Vietnam, I think always could see that there was a greater good. But I worry that our current generation, I mean, I'm in my mid-50s and you're younger than that. I just, we've never had that kind of common shared experience to kind of lift our country on our backs and carry it down the street. It's always been about us. It's always about me, if that makes any sense. And I worry about the future of our country because I worry that there are very few people that are in members of Congress that do think that way. It's almost
and like, who embody that.
Exactly.
He was the link, generational link to that concept.
And Bob Dole was like that as well.
Bob Dole, very much the same. And so I think that's what's very alarming about it. And I think it's very telling that both former presidents Obama and Bush are going to be given eulogies at his funeral because both were opponents of his, but both had great respect for him and as he did them. I've been racking my brain trying to think if there's anybody else that really embodies it to the degree that he does, that mentality. And I can't think of anybody. And that's what's so disappointing.
And if there were somebody, they're gone. From his own state, Jeff Flake may have tried to pick up that mantle.
Right.
He's gone. Bob Corker, who's been a little in and out, but he tried to take some stands. Anybody that could have filled that void in the Senate, I think, has decided it's just not on the Republican side. Has said it's not. It's just not worth it.
Yeah.
So, and something I wanted to do too is there's two quotes that I just love from Senator McCain that I wanted to go ahead and read. So the first is from his farewell letter. And so if you hadn't had a chance to read that yet, it's online. It's very moving. So this is the last piece of writing he did. But this is a quote from that letter. He said, "We weaken our greatness when we confuse our patriotism with tribal rivalries that have sown resentment and hatred and violence in all corners of the globe. We weaken it when we hide behind walls rather than tear them down, when we doubt the power of our ideals rather than trust them to be the great force for change that they always have been." And that was emblematic of, the America that he envisioned and how he saw our society and saw ourselves. And that's, I think, really touching. And he spoke out forcefully for America's ideals in all corners of the world and being able to advocate for oppressed peoples. There is one other quote that's also, I think, it's a little bit lighter, but it's just as This was from his last speech he gave on the floor of the Senate. And this one was a little bit more pushing back against the trends that he saw, the very in polarization and hyperpartisanship, and especially what's happening with demagoguery on both sides. He said, quote, "I hope we can again rely on our humility, on our need to cooperate, on our dependence on each other, to learn how to trust each other again, and by doing so, better serve the people who elected us. Stop listening to the bombastic loudmouths on the radio and television and the internet. To hell with them. They don't want anything done for the public good. Our incapacity is their livelihood." And I think that is so correct and so accurate.
Yeah. Yeah. Go ahead.
The one person we haven't mentioned this whole podcast is the existing president of the United States. And I think in honor of John McCain's death, we're not going to mention his name. It would be easy to contrast his childish, ignorant behavior this week with the life of John McCain, but that brings down the memory of John McCain. The two don't even belong in the same sentence together.
I can't outdo what Senator McCain wrote, but I will share that as I was reflecting on his life, I did make the observation I posted on Facebook that that he was the principal public servant that I think we all aspire to become.
Well put.
Yeah. All right, so that's like an hour. So, Mike, thanks for coming back and giving us all the campaign stuff. And
I didn't give you all the juicy stuff. I guess I'll do that later.
We got to have like an outtakes. You talk about the most horrible and
yeah. You were going to ask me those questions, like the most horrible food.
We got on to, but I want to. Yeah, what food did you eat? What was the worst campaign stop you made? And you can generify it, so you know, to keep the names of the innocent. But who had the worst food? What was the times you sat? What was the stupidest answer you heard somebody say?
I'll tell you, I had that one.
Oh, that one's right at the top of your head. We'll end with this one.
A little bonus extra. It wasn't the stupidest answer. Here's what I was most surprised by. We had a candidate forum at a mosque, and it was an Islamic community that actually hosted us. And what I could not believe, and this goes back to like always having your standard answer to this common question. So every time we got asked about immigration, it was always no kids in cages, don't build a wall, family reunification, like those kind of like it's typical things. Yeah, those were the kind of the stock answers for immigration. We're sitting in a mosque, and I was stunned that when we got asked the question about immigration there, that all the other candidates except for me used their stock answer.
Yeah.
Because I'm okay, we're sitting in a mosque, okay? The two issues that matter to people that are here, they are probably here legally, and their two issues are family reunification and H-1B visas.
And travel ban.
And travel ban, exactly.
And chain migration and other stuff.
And that's family reunification. And so it's like, what I couldn't believe is that not even in that context were some candidates aware enough or woke enough, if you will, to say, okay, wait a second, where am I? And I need to give a slightly different answer because it's a bigger issue than the kind of the 90 seconds that I learned on the campaign trail.
It's the Kellyanne Conway effect. No matter what you say, I just say the same four things over and over again.
There were many times where it was difficult to answer questions because I knew too much. That there wasn't really always a simple answer to questions. So sorry to ramble on about
that. Sorry. All right. That's our hour. We always end it. Do we have anything else we need to talk about this week? Mike's looking at his phone, so I'm guessing that's a no.
There's nothing.
All right. Thanks, guys.
Thanks.